Welcome everyone to our review of Miketz and Vayigash 5777, the Joseph identity. For those of you who are big Robert Ludlum fans, like I was when I was a kid, you remember the famous Bourne identity. So we have the Joseph, the Yosef identity. Tonight I would like to preface our talk with two questions. And two questions, as we will see tonight, are interrelated, and they are famous questions. Question one, why did Joseph not directly contact his father and his family to say, I'm alive? That's question one. Question two is, how come the brothers, for all of their efforts, and for all of the little breadcrumbs and the hints that the brothers were given by Joseph, they really never were able to identify their own brother, which is almost a more profound question, okay? And I think at the end of tonight, we will see that the questions are interrelated. Mrs. Minkoff, you have an approach that you want to share about?
Not an approach, I think, because they made a cherub.
Excellent, excellent. There is a concept that the brothers made a cherem. They made like a solemn vow to put in excommunication, to use a nice term from the church, to excommunicate anyone who spoke about the sale of Joseph. Wow. But because they did this, did not necessarily mean that Joseph, who was the unfortunate victim of their anger, rage, and resentment, he didn't necessarily have to follow that. Some say another approach, but I like that very much. Thank you. Another approach possibly is that the dreams that he had about them were neviut. They were prophetic in nature. And if you recall, in the dreams, it foretold the brothers bowing down. But the numbers did not include the brothers until the end. And so the dreams had to be fulfilled. That's one possible, but perhaps not entirely satisfactory approach. I want to offer something else with which we will sink our teeth into tonight. So let's begin. Number one, direct quote from Genesis 42, Membes. Now Yosef was the ruler over the land of Egypt. It was he who sold grain to the entire populace of the land. And Joseph's brothers came and prostrated themselves to him. Now remember, at this point, it is sons Benjamin. There's no Benjamin in the equation. The dream, of course, had how many bowing down? 11. Here it's only 10, so the dream has yet to be fulfilled. With their faces to the ground. And Joseph saw his brothers, and he recognized them. But he made himself a stranger to them, and he spoke to them harshly. And he said to them, "Where do you come from?" And they said, "From the land of Canaan to purchase food." Now Joseph recognized his brothers. It's reiterated a second time. But they did not recognize him. And Joseph remembered the dreams that he had dreamed about them. And he said to them, "Miraglim atem, you are spies. You have come to see the nakedness of the land, the secrets of the land." Now, just a simple reading of these verses, you can see that there is a dependent clause. Look at the second last verse. And Joseph remembered the chalomos, the dreams that he had dreamed about them, and then he accuses them of being spies. Those two are interdependent, which is perhaps an approach. Meaning, it is because of the dreams and the nature of how the dreams fell out. If you recall, the ears of grain bowing down, his went up and remained up, a sign of perhaps kingship. The second dream, the sun, the star, this moon bowing down to him, right? Again, it seems like there is a smichut, a parshiot. There's this subject matter that goes from one and it is interdependent on the other. Because of the dreams and the necessity that Joseph felt that they were from God, therefore they had to come true, that he starts the accusation against them. You are spies. Seems that the two are interdependent. That's one possible approach. Question, how come he recognized them, but they did not recognize him? Well, Rashi deals with this in number 2 and number 3. Have a look. Now Joseph recognized, so Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, Rashi explains, because he had left them, I don't like pronouns, Joseph had left his brothers when they were already full bearded. There was a considerable age gap between Joseph and his older brothers, especially Reuben, Shimon, Levi, and Yehuda. So therefore, they already had their beards. Whereas, in number three, but they, lo hikiruhu, they did not recognize him. Why? Because when Joseph left his brothers, he was 17 years old. He did not have a full beard. And now they found him full bearded. Now, if this is supposed to be a satisfactory answer, it's a little bit lacking. So we're going to try to understand, perhaps by the end of this evening, what Rashi really is talking about here. Yes, Mr. Birnbaum.
Right, no,
yes.
I know. How shocked was he when they showed up?
Excellent question. Anyone want to deal with that before I weigh in? He wasn't shocked at all.
He was prophetic. He knew that they were coming.
He was also expecting them because he knew from the dreams of Pharaoh. Do you recall that the thin cows, the skinny cows, and the fat cows, the skinny cows went away from the Nile River. The fat cows remained next to the Nile River. That was actually a sign that the famine, in the metaphor of the skinny cows, would not be limited to the Nile River basin, which was Egypt, but would extend to other regions in the Middle East, including Israel. Knowing that the famine was in Canaan, in Israel, it was inevitable that Joseph's brothers would have to come down at some point. Now, how do we know this? Because midrashically, in the oral tradition, Joseph informed his TSA agents to be on the lookout for some characters, all called Ben Yaakov. So he entered all the information into the computers. So when the brothers came to the gates to check in, and they did their little fingerprint and retinal scans, immediately they came up as suspicious characters to be brought directly to the king. So he was actually anticipating their arrival and preparing for their arrival. Now it's interesting to note, before I get to Philip's comment, that they entered through 10 separate gates. Is this what you wanted to say? Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to steal your thunder. Tell us. I'll stop there. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to mention that the reason they were suspicious is because they all came in through separate gates instead of coming in together. Like,
why would they have done that? Do you remember? Because you're absolutely dead on.
I think they were trying to see what was going on.
And to find.
And they were searching for Joseph.
Right, right, exactly. Beautiful. Wow, very impressive. In other words, they had sold him 22 years earlier. Now, there's a chance he's alive. They saw the devastation that the Mechiras Yosef, the sale of Joseph, had caused the dear old Yaakov Avinu. They thought, you know, there is a chance Joseph's alive and well. So they spread out throughout the land of Egypt to try to maximize the Columbo effect. Scout out the land. Ask questions. Was there a Jewish slave, Hebrew slave? Does anyone know? That's one possibility. The other is there was an ayin hara, that they didn't want to come in 10 very handsome men through one gate, and somehow everyone sees them. Oh, look at these 10 guys. They're all handsome. They're all brothers. And somehow it could bring misfortune on them. Of course, the irony is the misfortune came regardless. Yes, Bruce.
But he was sold several times.
Correct. He was sold. Of course. He was sold, as Bruce mentions. They mention, actually, in the actual Parsha, there was a caravan of Ishmaelites, and then there was another caravan that came by. It's not clear who sold whom. But the reason they mention the different caravans is to tell us there were multiple sales, ending up, of course, with Potiphar, buying him for sale. Now, remember, what was the first purpose of a sale back then for a young, handsome boy? I mean, it's not nice, but it's sexual slavery. Mm-hmm. So, especially when you have the most handsome kid in the world at 17 years old. So the brothers knew this. So they spread out in an attempt to find Joseph and to bring him back at any cost.
If he was sold to someone else first, the Ishmaelites, how would they know that he ended up in Egypt? He could have ended up
they knew the destination of the Ishmaelites. The Ishmaelites were carrying unique products. And we know this because it tells us explicitly what their wares were, and these wares were unavailable in Egypt. Therefore, they had a premium price in the marketplace in Egypt. And there's a side point. Do you remember how it mentions the sweet-smelling spices that they carried? And do you remember the the beautiful idea there that I mentioned in passing. I'll mention it because it's beautiful. Joseph was the beneficiary of sweet-smelling spices. So instead of stinky kerosene and other foul-smelling items that were the norm for Ishmaelite caravans to be carrying down to Egypt, in honor of Joseph, they were carrying Christian Dior and, you know, Estee Lauder, beautiful colognes and spices and perfumes. So the rabbis say, okay, wait a minute. Do we really care? I mean, really? Here's the guy, 17 years old, young man, betrayed, almost killed and murdered by his own brothers, taken down to an unknown, uncertain future, if any. Do you think he really even was aware that there were sweet-smelling spices on the caravan? I mean, really, that's the best you can do, Hashem? And Rabbi Shmuel Levitz, the late Mir Rosh Hashiva, says something beautiful, that it was a gift from God. It was a shmetavik, a little tiny little gift to Joseph. That Joseph, I know you think that this is the darkest, lowest point of your life. Actually, that won't happen until you get to jail, but that's another story. But at this point, you think it cannot get worse, right? I'm with you. The proof that I am with you is that there's a little tiny detail of sweet-smelling spices. And if you will just smell the sweet-smelling spices, it will give you on some level an awareness that no matter how bleak and dark it may look, I am with you all the way. And every step of your journey, God is with you. So it's a beautiful idea that sometimes in our own lives, when we have difficulties and real travails and challenges, if we will just listen and smell and pay attention to small details, it could give us a sense of comfort that we're not alone and that Hashem is with us. It's a beautiful idea, concept here. So let's get back to this story. So the brothers come down. They are aware of the destination, if you will, of the Ishmaelites. They're not sure where exactly in Egypt land they're going to go. And there's no guarantee, as you said, Bruce, that he's even going to wind up in Egypt. It could be he'll be sold to Egypt, and then maybe he'll be taken elsewhere, right? To Marrakesh or something, right? Yes?
But the whole world was converging on Egypt at the time because they're the only ones with food.
Correct.
So no matter where he got sold, they had a good shot of finding him.
Correct, correct. And since that was the original destination, reasonable. Right.
But he was sold age 17 and 22 years went by, he's 39.
Correct.
You know, I'm not sure what the life expectancy was those days. 39 could be the outer limits.
Could be. It could be.
120 having kids at 130.
Well, the Jewish people, we did okay. Baruch Hashem, yeah. We were a little yeah, we were good. So he, Joseph, takes this knowledge of the brothers and the expectation, as you said, that they're coming, and he twists it. He says, let me ask you a question. Your spies. What's the brother's response? Remember? No. Can't even happen. We're truth tellers. Achim anachnu, b'nei ish echad. We're all brothers, the son of one individual who lives in the land of Israel as we speak. He said, really? Why didn't you enter Egypt through one entry point? Oh, well, you know, one of us is not around. They didn't say they had sold him into slavery and he may be dead. One of us is not around. And we were hoping to find him. So we spread out to maximize the search effort. Oh, and what would you do, he went on to tease them, if you found this missing brother? Well, we would redeem him. Well, what if his new master didn't want him to be redeemed? He likes your brother. We came to kill or be killed. Exactly what I said, Joseph says to them. You're spies. You're violent people. You're ready to hurt and harm my people. Therefore, Joseph uses all of the knowledge that he has about his brothers and twists it and turns it as only Joseph. Remember, he's had a really long time to plan this out.
He's playing with them.
He is. He is.
Is he talking Hebrew to them?
No. Excellent question. It says that there was a melitz. There was a translator. You remember the old UN? You know, the guys all speaking. They have those little silly little headphones on, and they're all listening to somebody speak in a foreign language, and they have the... Right? Correct. His own son, Menashe, was the one translating. So Menashe would hear them speak Lishon HaKodesh, the Holy Tongue Hebrew, and then he would turn to his father, which was totally unnecessary. It was all a ruse. And he would translate into Egyptian, into Mitzri, for the benefit of his father. And then it would go back and forth and back and forth. Of course,
Menashe didn't know what was going on.
Of course he did. He was all part of this. He's a critical component in Joseph's plan.
So he told him that he had to tell his son.
Sure, that these are your uncles. But now, there's a question that nobody asks. Where in the world does the Egyptian get such fluent knowledge of Hebrew? Joseph. Rosetta Stone wasn't invented.
But the leaders of the world, and that does
could be, yeah. They were, and they would seek out individuals that would have foreign tongues. Okay, you can make the argument. But Menashe was always between them and most of the, it says, Ki hamelitz beno sam. The translator was always between them. And in fact, there's an amazing scene when Joseph's responds to the brother's pain. They actually verbally say in Hebrew in front of him, because Menashe was in the bathroom apparently or somewhere else, they felt it was safe to speak in front of Joseph. So they all look at each other. Reuven reprimands them. Says, I told you not to touch the boy, but you all didn't listen. And now look at all the pain and suffering that's coming down on us. It's all payback time, guys. Ashemim anachnu. We're all guilty here. And when Joseph hears this, he runs out of the room and cries because he's full of emotion. He understands them perfectly. They would never have openly spoken like this in front of him. They thought it was safe because, after all, the translator's in the bathroom. What's the point? Right? Okay. Let's carry on. So Rashi says Joseph recognizes them. He, in fact, planned the entire ruse way ahead of time. It was all a game. We don't know why. But they did not recognize him, Rashi says, because he had left town without a beard. Now he had a beard. Ramban, Nachmanides says, he had a little bit of a gangster look. He had a Borsellino hat, and he kind of wore it over his eyes a little bit, you know, kind of hid him a little bit. The beard, the hat. Apparently that was enough.
20 years.
Apparently that was enough.
From 20 to 40, you change quite a bit. From 40 to 60, you don't change.
Okay. So much. Absolutely, you're right. But it's still not really a satisfactory answer. We have to really get into the nitty gritty. Okay. Joseph now begins to throw hints at the brothers. Now, at the end of tonight's class, I will try to offer you an approach as to why Joseph needed them to pick up on the hints and figure out on their own what was going on. And they never did. Judah, Yehuda, bless his heart, tries desperately to put it all together. Can't do it. We'll have to answer why. Okay? So let's see hint number one. It's extraordinary. Look at this. Number five. Joseph selects all the brothers to be incarcerated for a couple of days. Puts them all in jail. They're spies. Lets them out of jail and says, look, guys, I changed my mind. Originally, I said, one goes back home, the rest stay. But I realize, after thinking about it, you guys will starve. One person can only carry a finite amount of food, and you guys have starving families. So I'm not a mean guy. I fear God. Maybe he said gods. You know, I can't say God because he can't say that he's Jewish. I fear God. So one of you stays, the rest go back home with massive amounts of food. And he looks around and he says, you. And he points to Shimon. Get him. Put him in jail. Now Shimon was his big brother, brother number two of the family. The rabbi said, why did he pick on Shimon? It wasn't a coincidence. Shimon did something that was very insulting, and he needed a little extra atonement. You know what Shimon did? Do you remember the famous story? Joseph's coming, and they look up, and they say, ah! One brother says to another, Hine here comes the big fat dreamer. Let's go kill him and throw him in one of the pits. Shimon made that comment to Levi. And they prove it. I won't go there. But it was Shimon making the comment to Levi. So I guess Shimon and Levi were the clear and present danger. You can ask the late citizens of Shechem how dangerous Shimon and Levi were. They were very formidable guys. So Shimon made the statement about Joseph that was very, very derisive at the very minimum. And they choose Shimon to lock him up. So Shimon looks around like this and says, okay, you and what army are going to lock me up? So Joseph says, guards, get him. So the 10 biggest, toughest Egyptian guards step up. This is all in the Midrash. And they say, you're in the jail now, sir. We're, you know, put your hands behind your back. He says, make me. And as they come towards him, he starts to physically hurt them. He just kind of whips his hand this way, and they go flying across this. He's a little bit like Bruce Lee. And about 30 seconds later, there's 10 Egyptian guards with bruises lying on the floor. So Shimon, again, looks at Tzafnat Paneach, Joseph's name, the explainer of hidden secrets, says, okay, go ahead, I challenge you. So he turns to Manasseh. He says, Manasseh, his son, doesn't call him Manasseh, says, take care of him. So Manasseh walks over to him. Apparently he also had a little karate knowledge. Gives him a couple hits. Boom, Shimon's on the ground and they throw him in jail. Shimon is stunned. Look at his reaction. Shimon said, it's a direct quote from the Midrash, all right, I want to see which one of you will be able to put me in prison. Joseph sent a messenger to Pharaoh, request it's even better. 70 of the mightiest warriors come. When the 70 arrived, Joseph told them to take a chain, put it around Shimon's neck, lock him up in prison. Shimon let out a war cry. This is very vivid, I love it. And the warriors all fell to the ground before him and shattered their teeth. Oops, sorry about that, Dr. Weiss. So you had some extra clientele.
Right.
Manasseh stood up beside his father Joseph. Joseph says, okay, kid, get him. He took the chain and he placed it on Shimon's neck. Manasseh struck Shimon with one blow, chained him up, and put him in prison. Shimon said in shock to his brothers, oh my gosh, that blow was a blow from someone of a Ben Yaakov from our father's house. That's not some wussy Egyptian hitting us. That was a serious blow. Okay, stop, gentlemen. Shimon says to his brothers, that was a Ben Yaakov. That was a son of Jacob hitting me. Oh, okay, stop, stop. And, new, how could that be, say you? Think, guys. How could that be? But no, apparently the dialogue stops. Shimon's in jail, and that's it. So Shimon even articulates the possibility that something is very strange in Egypt.
But he meant it metaphorically, necessarily.
Okay, but it's very interesting that he actually articulates those words. Fascinating. All right, number six. They go back home to Dear Dad. Levi has a heart attack because he opens up his fodder that he's going to give to his animals at the Holiday Inn on their way back. And it says that all the money that they had paid for the shever, for the food supplies, was right there in his sack. And he just is shattered. He calls his brother, says, the money's been returned. We gave it. We paid in full. Someone put it back. Now, why would somebody put it back? It's a setup. They want to accuse us of being thieves. It's bad enough that we're accused of being spies, but now apparently we're thieves. This is all a setup. Of course, when they get home and they all empty their sacks, everyone's money is back. So when they go back to dear old dad, Yaakov Avinu, look what Yisrael, dad, says to them. He says, Lama harayosimli, why have you, I don't like the word harmed, why have you done bad to me? By telling the man, lahagid la'ish, hayishalchem ach, that you have another brother Benjamin. In other words, loose lips sink ships, guys. Why would you even give the man information about your family that there is a Benjamin? He wouldn't know there's a Benjamin. And the fact that now he is desirous of Benjamin coming is your big mouth. So you know what their response is? Listen to this response. They said to their dad, this is amazing. The man asked about us and about our family. It means he fired us, he grilled us, he waterboarded us, and he said, is your father still alive? Do you have a brother? And we told him according to these words. Could we have known that he would say, bring brother Benjamin down? Look at Rashi, about us and our family. He asked us about our yichus, our lineage. Midrashically, in the oral tradition, it is explained, even the matters of our cradles he revealed to us. He knew the decor in our nursery rooms. How could we withhold Benjamin's existence from this man? Now stop for a second. Stop for a minute. Right. Now wait a minute. Okay. Dad, he described for us that I had a little play school thing up on the wall, and you had a little Snoopy over there, was your little transitional toy, and we had, you know, we had the little singing little fish that put us to sleep at night, and the okay, he's a smart guy. I will give you this. How could such information be in the possession of an Egyptian king? Hello? What is the possible conclusion? What's the only possible conclusion? But they somehow don't, that they're spy, that he's a better spy than they are. Right. Maybe he has a little like a drone airplanes flying over the land of Canaan. I mean, I ask you, this is such a giveaway. But nobody picks up on it. Please turn the page. It's I think it's an amazing answer, but isn't it shocking? Shimon articulating, he's got to be someone who hits like a Jew, right? The decor of our nursery, he knows. It gets worse. Number 8. And the man, Menashe again, this is when the brothers have returned with all the money that was placed in their sacks and double the money, just in case, you know, they would have to buy extra food and they could prove and validate that they were not thieves. So they have a whole amazing long series of verses where they basically say, excuse me, sir, come here. And they take Menashe aside. And they say, we don't know what happened, but we went back and we went to the hotel and we were emptying our sacks and the money was there. We don't know how it got there. And he says, Shalom, relax. God obviously gave you a gift. We received your money in full, paid for. No one's going to accuse you of being thieves. It's actually hysterical when you read it. It's like a whole long diatribe, and he just says one word. Relax. Shalom. It's okay. I received every penny. There's no issue here. Is there an issue? So what happens? And the man did as Joseph had said, Menashe, his son. And he brought his uncles, the men, into Joseph's house, into the palace. Now the men were frightened because they had been brought into Joseph's house. And they said, oh my gosh. And this is right before they give him his long diatribe, how we have all this money. He says, it must be that we've been brought to the palace, not to eat, but to perhaps work KP duty in the kitchen. We're going to be slaves. Because what happens to a thief? They become slaves by Jewish law and apparently by Egyptian law. You steal, you can't pay back. You become an eved, you become a slave. So when they saw that they were brought to the palace, they said, oh my gosh. It's on account of the money that came back in our sacks at first. We are brought to roll upon us, meaning a false accusation, and to fall upon us and take us as slaves and our donkeys as well. Stop. Now this makes entire sense, correct? Because just think about this scenario. You've been accused falsely, of course, of being spies. The money is a setup. You come back, you immediately tell the man, here's the money. We don't know how it reappeared in our sacks. And they say, oh, not a problem. God gave you a gift. And by the way, wash up because the king's going to have you for lunch.
Literally.
Literally. Now, this makes entire sense, right? So you go from months, because they had months to think about this before they got permission to bring Benjamin, right? So you have months where you are fixating day and night on the money, how it got there, was it an accident, what's the plan, it doesn't make sense. And of course, every accused spy gets to lunch with the king. I mean, really? This is reasonable, of course. Okay, all right. Number 9. Joseph, of course, had one brother that he did not have a bravus, did not have any ill will against. His little brother Benjamin. He had missed out on the entirety of Benjamin's becoming an adult. Benjamin's 30 years old now, so he is lamenting the loss of the time together of the two children of Rachel. And Joseph lifted his eyes and saw Benjamin, his brother, the son of his mother. So it's telling you how profound the relationship is. And he said, is this your little brother whom you told me about? So some say he's mocking them because he's 30 years old and he's like 6'2", 210 pounds. And they're all describing him as Achinu Hakaton, Einenu, right? Our little brother. And they're saying, really? Guy could be a linebacker for the Packers, but he's your Achicha Hakaton. Really? He's your little baby brother, right? And he said, Joseph to Benjamin, may God favor you, my son. He blesses him. And Joseph hastened. He ran out of the room. For his mercy was stirred toward his brother Benjamin, and he wanted to weep. So he went into the room, meaning away from the brothers, and he wept there. He washed his face, he came out, he restrained himself, he fortified himself for the rest of the theatrical performance, and he said, serve the food. Again, if you are the brothers, the king comes in, and he sees your brother. They're not idiots. They see the face of Joseph well up with tears. And then you see him well up with tears, sprint out of the room, and then come back. It's strange. So you're looking at the king's reaction, Benjamin, the king. What's going on? Why is he reacting this way? Okay, what could the possibilities be? But the brothers don't put the pieces together. All right, number 10. The brothers sat before Joseph, the firstborn Reuven according to his age, and the youngest according to his youth. And the men looked at each other in astonishment. Now, why were they astonished? Because the brothers all were born within a couple of years, save Benjamin. Remember, you had in quick order Leah's four children, Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, and then automatically Bilhah comes in with Dan, Naphtali. Then you get Yisachar, you get Gad Asher's Yisachar Zebulun. All those brothers are born only a couple of years apart. They were impossible to tell apart. They all had the beards. They all had the Jewish look. They're all handsome. So to an outsider, to distinguish at this point in their lives, when they're all in their 40s, essentially, who is the firstborn, the second, the third, the fourth, the fifth, is an impossibility. But Joseph had a little game here. He can't tell them he's Joseph, so he pretends to be a magician. What does he do? He takes his silver goblet, picks it up, Kiddush cup, you know, and he's bar mitzvah, probably says, presented to Joseph, son of Jacob, by congregation of Tzedek on the occasion of your bar mitzvah here, right? So he picks up his Kiddush cup, and he holds it up, and he pretends it's a magic gavia. It's a magic goblet, all to prepare for the plant of the goblet in Benjamin's sack in a few short verses. So he picks up his goblet, and he announced, Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, Yisachar, Zvulun, sons of one mother, sit in this order at that table right here. And then he went through all the family. When he reached Benjamin, he said, you know, according to my goblet, you don't have a mom. Guess what? Your mom died at 36, I see. My mother coincidentally died at age 36. We share this. Wow. How about you sit at the head table with me? But now, again, clueless in Canaan. Brothers, nothing is resonating with them at all, right? I mean, it's unbelievable.
It's the farthest thing in their mind that their brother should be the king.
Okay, but we have to understand why.
And they figure he has spies and he went out.
Right.
And
so, exactly. You're right. But let's just try to get a grasp on this. Number 12. Then Joseph commanded Manasseh, the overseer of his house, and he said, look, he said, here's the end game. Fill the men's sacks with food, as much as they can carry, and put each man's money into the mouth of his sack, and my goblet that I used for the big fake-out, the Kiddush cup, the silver goblet, put into the mouth of the sack of Benjamin the youngest, and his purchase money. And of course, Manasseh did according to Joseph's word, which he had spoken. Stop. What happens next, of course, the brothers are sent home, bye, and then immediately, a group led by Manasseh of commando soldiers are sent immediately on fast horses to overtake the brothers. Not a big deal. They've just left the city. They haven't gone far. They said, how come you pay back our master bad for good? He treated you like you were mensches, like you were good guys. And what did you do? You repaid it with stealing his favorite goblet. Do you really think that a man who's a wizard, like my master, Manasseh says, the king of all the land of Egypt, you really didn't think he was going to pick up on this little thing? And the brothers, of course, are looking around. What? Who, us? What are you talking about? How dare you accuse us of this? The person who you find the goblet should not live. And all of us are prepared to be slaves. Now, in this, Joseph has just recreated the most famous, vivid scene from the real lives of these young men. Anyone remember that scene? Lavan, Rachel, steals her dad's favorite idols.
Right.
Doesn't tell anybody. They leave town. Lavan pursues and catches up to them. Remember the accusation to Jacob? You stole my favorite idols. The person who you found them with, if you find it with any of us, that person should die. Because unbeknownst to Jacob, Rachel stole them. Exact scenario, recreated, item for item by Joseph. Brothers, does this ring a bell? No, apparently not. So they come back, they search Shimon, they search Benjamin's sack. According to Rashi, they only searched those two because the brothers had a defense. They said, wait a minute, we brought all the money back that we thought was stolen, quote unquote. We proved our innocence. We're not thieves. So Joseph says, okay, I like your theory. Nice theory, Manasseh says, but Shimon was in jail the whole time. He didn't validate his honesty. And little brother Benjamin, he was home with dad. So let's just search those two sacks. So they began with Shimon's sack, Benjamin's sack, goblet. They run back and Joseph's waiting for them in the palace. And he says, really? This is how you treat me? He says, okay, guys, Benjamin stays with me as a slave. The rest of you go back to dear brother, dear father, Yaakov. Have a nice life. Bye. Of course, that's how Parshas Mikes ends. And we know by Yigash what happens. Judah comes forward. The brothers shy away. The showdown between the two future kings of Israel, Judah and Joseph. Judah tries to put all the pieces together. And he's really good. He says, let me get this straight. And some say by Yigash Elah that who was the person who he came close to? God. He says, God, let me try to understand what's going on in my life. Because every minute, it's accusations of being spies, and then we're lunching with the king. What gives here? We came to buy food to try to find our baby brother, and this nightmare scenario keeps reappearing its ugly face. What's going on? And he tries, and he sums up all of the craziness of their lives, and he can't figure it out. And then it says fateful words. Joseph could no longer hold himself back. What's the implication? He wanted to hold himself back. Judah drew him out. Some say through threats, because he basically said, I'll kill you and everybody else in Egypt unless you release Benjamin right now. You think this is a problem? Ask Levi and Shimon what happened to the men of Shechem when they took our sister Dinah. We're ready to do battle. I'll start with you, big mouth, he says to Tzapnas Paneah, and I'll end with Pharaoh. Not a problem. Ready, brothers? And of course, at that point, Joseph realizes, this is reality. I could get killed here by my own brothers, and they don't even know who I am. So at that point, he's drawn out. Others say it was the fact that Judah now has proven himself to be a Baal Teshuva. He's repented for his crime. He's the one, if you recall, who sold Joseph. Remember what he said to his brothers? Ma betza. What gain is it for us if we kill our brother? Let's sell him, make a few bucks on it. Joseph doesn't forget this. So when Judah is up to the amazing task that he's ready to step in for Benjamin, he says, look, what do you want Benjamin for? Work? I'm a lot stronger. Brain power? I'm better. And he lists a whole checklist. He says, whatever you want to say, I'm Superman. So I'll stay. Benjamin goes home to dad. How do you like that? And of course, Joseph's having nothing of this. And then in the end, Judah proves to Joseph that he has done teshuvah, that he's repented. Okay, let's look at number 13. Joseph said to his brothers, I am Joseph. Ha'od avichai. Two words. Ani Yosef. I am Joseph. Is my father still alive, Jacob? But his brothers could not answer him because they were startled. It says, Nivhalu. They were discombobulated by his presence. Why?
He spoke to them in Hebrew.
He definitely spoke to them in Hebrew, no question. Why was it such a shock? So would you all agree that Joseph laid, and I only touched on some of the major hints. There's many more subtle hints that Joseph's throwing out. So let's answer question one. Why did Joseph need the brothers desperately to figure it out on their own? Why couldn't he just announce right away, I'm Joseph, this is all God's plan, I forgive you, dear brothers, welcome to Egypt, let's get dad.
He wanted them to do penance. He wanted them to suffer a little bit.
You want to assess their level of penance over the past years.
So he puts them to the test, and when he sees that Judah passes the test, that a son of Rachel, Benjamin, who is like him, a son of Rachel, that he's in desperate situation, how would Judah react? And Judah passes the test. It's now time to say, I'm Joseph. Very good. Good answer. Let me offer you something else. When you have a paradigm shift of this enormity, it's very hard for the people who are living at the time of the change to buy into the change. I'll give you one of the greatest paradigm shifts of the last 1,000 years. Copernicus. Okay, up to Copernicus, who the church literally excommunicated and wanted to kill him. He came up with the idea, you know, instead of putting the Band-Aid approach on how come the elliptical, you know, orbits of the planets and that it doesn't make sense, and they kept having to have theories to explain how come things happen if the Earth is the center of our galaxy, it doesn't make sense, right? Copernicus says, well, what if the Sun was and the Earth simply, oh, right? So in a pre-Copernican world, if you were alive at that time, and then you transitioned into the post-Copernican world, it's very hard to accept such a change. That's a paradigm shift of enormous proportions. But what about if you're born into it? It becomes a reality, right? In other words, I'm born into a world where I open the World Book of Almanacs, and it tells me how my universe or how my world functions. not a problem. When Einstein develops the theory of relativity in 1920, 21, by the way, he never got the Nobel Prize for that. You know, they stole it from him. They gave it to him a year later for another invention, but not for relativity, which is kind of stunning. So when Einstein comes up with relativity, how many people in the world understand relativity at the time of Einstein? Maybe a handful of scientists? But what about the young men and women who are born into a post-Einstein relativity world and learn it in college or learn it in a high school level? It's not so daunting because it becomes the reality. Look at computers. You take someone who's very aged and did not ever, ever use a computer as a child. Look at a child, throw him an iPad. Try this. Try it with my own son. I don't have to give him a guidebook. That's why there are no guidebooks. You ever wonder why tablets and iPhones don't have any user manuals? Because you don't need them. I give Tully an iPad. He knows more tricks in 10 minutes than I do. He just, boom, right? And it's like, what? Because he is just born into a world where this is a reality. He's not daunted by it. Joseph understood that if he just says, I am Joseph, it's not going to be accepted by the brothers. It's not going to really resonate with the brothers. He needs the brothers to have the paradigm shift of what their lives have meant. Now think about it. If you're Judah, how have you lived your life in the last 22 years? You've lived a lie. Because all along, you believed Joseph was one thing, and the reality is the opposite of what you believed. I'll take it a step further. You accused Joseph of delusions of grandeur, visions of kingship, ruling the world, lording it over us. How do you think the brothers would feel when they realized, oh my gosh, not only did the dreams come true, but we were the very instruments that God used to fulfill his dreams. Oh my gosh. So Joseph knew this. But if the brothers could somehow on their own put all the little pieces together, then that paradigm shift would occur in a very positive way. It didn't. He was forced to announce, I'm Joseph. That makes a lot of sense. Let me parallel this with the people who left Egypt. Only two men that we know of, Joshua and Caleb, who were born in Egypt, lived to get into the promised land of Israel. All the others, including Moses and Aaron, died in the desert. They could not make that shift between life in Egypt and life in Israel. It just couldn't happen.
I thought there was a group that lived at the last.
Could be, but the women did, for sure. We know women did, but not the men. So again, it's a huge issue. So perhaps that's one explanation. Joseph needed the brothers on their own to reach the conclusion. And you know yourself, if something's foisted on you, a truth, it doesn't resonate, it doesn't reach your inner recesses of your soul and your mind unless you figure it out. A little light goes on. Oh, how could he know the nursery decor? Must be Joe. But no. They never got to that conclusion. How about our second question, which I think is more profound? How come they don't recognize him? I think there's a very simple reason. Context.
They didn't want to.
A lack of context. Let's think back for a moment. Joseph tells the brothers the dreams. I have a question for you. Who interpreted the dreams? Did Joseph interpret the dreams?
No.
The brothers interpreted the dreams. They heard facts on the ground. The sun, the moon, stars. Joseph didn't say, oh, by the way, that means I'm going to be the king of the world and you all are going to be subservient to me. They interpreted it. You're going to rule over us? You're going to lord it over us? But that wasn't the interpretation. You know what the real interpretation was? Yes, Joseph would become the king of the world, but it would be a benevolent dictatorship. It would be positive. I'm going to save your lives. God will put me in a place where I uniquely will be able to save the lives of all my family members and put in place the pieces that we need for Jewish continuity during the slavery. So it's fantastic. Joseph never supplied the interpretation, the explanation. The brothers chose to. So the brothers supplied their own nightmare vision. So in answer to what you said, Doc, they could never see Joseph, because how could this be Joseph? He's not the king. They created, through their interpretation, an artificial reality. So no matter how hard Joseph tries, with all the little breadcrumbs of hints, the brothers who've already created an artificial reality for themselves can't possibly see Joseph, no matter how hard he tries. It had no effect on them. The context was lacking. How could it be Joseph? Now, I believe I shared this story once before, but it's an amazing story. My own Rebbe, Rabbi Weinberg, my Rebbe, my teacher. Real story. And he's a brilliant, brilliant man, like about a 200 IQ. He's like an amazing thinker. So when I tell you the story, you're going to laugh, but you'll understand this is coming from a super genius person, okay? So Rabbi Weinberg, a few years back, is on an airplane traveling from Israel, where he lives, to America. And as he's walking back at the back of the airplane, probably to Davin, one of the famous shachris is on El Al, he sees a gentleman, Jewish guy, sitting in one of the seats next to the window. He looks at him, and there's like a recognition there. But he just can't put a name to the face. So he thinks to himself, you know, I don't want to embarrass myself or the poor person by saying, who are you? Because he looks vaguely familiar. I'm not sure, but I could be wrong, but I'm not, you know. So he leaves it alone. 3 days later, he's in New York area at a family wedding, which is the reason for his trip to America. And he walks into the wedding hall, and who does he see sitting there at one of the tables? The same guy! So he thinks to himself, no, wait a minute, this is insane. He's on the airplane coming from Israel, and now he's at my family's simcha. We somehow have to have crossed paths before. So he walks over to the man, and he says, you know, sir, I'm embarrassed to say that I must know you from somewhere. I saw you on the airplane, here you're at my family wedding. Do we know each other? He says, Rabbi Weinberg, I'm your dentist. Think about it. Think about the context. You're lying down in the dentist's office. The dentist is coming over you with the, right? You have the special, the light and the smock. You are looking from a perspective totally different than the real world. But that's the only time that Rabbi Weinberg ever interrelated with this individual. So the context is wrong. How many times in your life have you met the checkout lady from Price Chopper or from wherever, and you see her for 25 years of your life, but you see her out of context of Price Chopper, and you're looking at her saying, holy smokes, I know that lady. Where do I know her from? Rabbi, I've been checking out your groceries for 18 years at Weiss Market. You should know me.
Somebody from Price Chopper did that. Somebody nice.
But it's stunning, right? So the brothers lack context. It can't be Joseph. So my Rosh Hashiva, my Rebbe, said that until that moment with his dentist, he did not understand this entire class. But it was like a lightning bolt of insight when he just embarrassed himself, but he really was like, wow. Yes, Tom.
In deference to the dentist, he only sees the rabbi or the other patient in the office when they're lying down, this or that. So when he sees them outside the dental office, he too loses context who they are. He may recognize them as a potential patient, but doesn't remember the name.
Right.
I do this all the time.
I hear you. But I guess the difference is that you look at your chart, you see the guy's name, and you're, right? I hear. I got in defense of dentists. Thank you. I appreciate that. So to end tonight with a couple of thoughts, what it means for us. I think the scary thing, the sobering message takeaway to me, is how much we, good or bad, supply our own reality in our lives. The context, the reality of the world we live in, is our own making. And we can make, as Joseph was hoping the brothers would make, the dreams fantastic. Brothers coming together, unity, harmony, everything good. And the brothers created their own reality, which was a nightmare reality. And perhaps when Joseph manipulated the situation and created this artificial universe for them, he's saying to them, you think it's so crazy that you go from accusations of spying to eat with the king and then back and forth? I'm showing you, I'm literally showing, I'm feeding you a context that makes it just doesn't make sense on any level. I need you to see that I'm supplying you a nightmare because I need you to see the dreams of as they are. Don't look into the dreams and supply your own. I'll share this last thought. There was a Rabbi Ben Ayai, the Gemara says, Talmud says, who had a very strange dream. So he went to the greatest dream interpreters in all of Jerusalem, They're all like Lucy, where you know, come in, you put 5 cents, and you get a dream interpretation, right, from Peanuts. So he went to each and every one of them. And all the interpreters, there were over 20 of them, each gave the rabbi a different interpretation. Guess what? They all came true. Because they were in his mind. So he created his own reality. That's why it says very clearly in our parsha that Ein Chalom Holech Ech Ella Achar Pisron, that dreams only follow the interpretation of the dream. The dream can be benevolent and a bracha and a blessing. But if we twist it, it becomes a nightmare for us. But conversely, we should all have schus, we should all have the merit that to live life as it really is, the blessing of reality, to supply context constantly for ourselves and to see all the gifts that we have, the myriad of blessings that God has in store, the dreams that we should still live out to their full, blessed conclusion. I wish everyone a good evening.